Stefan, welcome.
Hello. Perfect.
You made it. I was worried about daylight savings time, but
Yeah,
apparently.
but I checked the table, you know.
Got it. Okay, everybody is very anxious to hear you today, very excited.
We won't exaggerate, right?
Right. So I'm going to just do a very brief introduction. And because I think most everybody actually knows who you are, and like I said, they're very excited to hear you.
Okay. Look, Tom, you have a reflection on your
I know.
choices. Okay.
I know there's nothing I can do about that.
Okay.
Let me just turn up the sound a little bit. So I am actually honored to have Stefan join us today. I am also very happy to, I think I can call Stefan a new friend of mine. And we've had a lot of collaboration in the past few months, and much to my benefit, I would say.
And to mine, you know.
And one thing I would say, which I was thinking about this, I can't really think of anybody who I think knows more about the history and the practice of virology than Stefan Lenka. But it's a curious thing to say that, because it reminds me of a few days ago, I was invited by a group of doctors to join a working group on viruses. And of course, I said, asked what time it was, and they said a time. And I said, oh, I can't do it at that time because that's when my meeting about unicorns is. To say you're an expert on viruses is a bit like being an expert on unicorns, although unicorns have prettier pictures. So it's a funny thing to say. But anyways, so with that, I just want to say what we're the things that we're hoping to hear or hoping you would address. First of all, is just the history of virology, which I've heard you speak on this before, and it really puts everything in context. The next thing, which I hear a lot from people, is has a pathogenic virus actually ever been seen from a sick human being? And it's a very interesting question, and I think I know the answer to that, but I will let you say it. And then we would love to hear about the experiments that you're doing now, and what it is that you're hoping to demonstrate, and why it's so important to demonstrate these things. And so with that, I am going to turn the floor over to Stefan, and he's going to tell us a little about the history of virology and how we got into this mess that we're in now. So again, welcome, Stefan.
Okay, welcome you, Tom, and hello to everybody. And Tom, thanks to you that you make the control experiments happen, which I'm going to talk soon on them, right? Okay, first, let's go into the history of virology, and we have to go all back 2,500 years, and we have to listen Plato when Plato is saying that the Greek medical doctors can't cope with most of diseases. He wrote this, and he gives an explanation for this catastrophe, which already happened at his time, right? And he said that when something it's not working, something it's ill, an organ, an eye, and bone, or something else, the doctors work on this, right? Where they see the symptom. But he says they all forgot the source of the organ, the source of the eye, the source of the bone. It's the soul. So they're not treating the soul. This is his criticism, and it's very, very sharp and very interesting, and it shows that something was going on already by then. And for me, I went from the history, of course, from me being a student of biology, and then I went back. First, of course, I went into marine biology in order to help the oceans not to get more polluted, not to collapse, because they are producing 70% of oxygen. Of course, then I found in a marine algae a structure in an organ where usually spores are built. Spores, which you can see with the light microscope, they are going to sit down, they are going to grow and build big algae again. Right. And in this algae, I observed that there were no spores produced, but an amorph mass. So I went with this in the electron microscope to see it's a fungi or fungal spores or what's going on. And I saw billions of small particles, hexagonal, like we think viruses look like. And I thought, whoa, I found a harmless virus and a harmless stable virus host relationship, because the production of the harmless virus was not doing harm to the algae. And I had really to fight to get a lab. And when I managed this, I could isolate this structure. And I thought I have a harmless virus. And then when another professor, a friend of mine, I could use his lab space. He was a real big specialist on nucleic acid and sequencing. And it was the Austrian professor Fritz Pohl. And he told me, hey, Stefan, did you check what you are telling to the students? You are warning in front of AIDS and HIV, and everybody should use double condoms. And so did you check this? And I said, the world is saying this. And he told me he was not asking the world. He was asking me. Anyway, I asked him why he has questions on this and why he's questioning this. And he told me that he heard some rumors that Gallo was manipulating. So I went, he said I should go immediately to the library and every paper of interest I should copy twice for him. And so we started to discuss on this thing. And this how I came into the history of virology. And very soon I realized that Gallo, in order to prove that he has a virus, he was killing his cell cultures. And the other one who eventually got the Nobel Prize in 2008 for HIV, the French Montagnier, he said, no, my virus, if it's a virus at all, then it's multiplying in the white blood cells. So we have an immunological overload. But what he was saying at this time already, if the people will stop using sexual drugs and eat good food, vitamins, and pure water, they even will get not only healthy, but get rid of the virus. So everybody was hating Montagnier, but in the end, he received the Nobel Prize in 2008. That's an important part of virology, because two different concepts. But it was the reason I saw that Gallo was really manipulating. He was killing his cell cultures with hydrocortisone. And I thought, so some probably more than Gallo and probably all the scene and the politicians are aware of this act of betraying. And so I thought virology is betrayal. And this was a big mistake. Because, of course, what I saw in both papers of Gallo and of Montagnier, I saw they claim a virus, but they never saw a virus like me. I could isolate a structure. I could see it in great number inside the host in an isolated form. I could do the biochemical analysis of all its proteins. And the most important thing, its genetic material. Always a given size, always the same structure, and always the same sequence. So, and in the paper of Montagnier and Gallo, nothing like this appeared. Only an enzymatic activity was equaled that there should be a virus somewhere else around. And as the cells were dying, that they think all the materials, or at least some of the materials of the cell cultures dying in the lab, are viral. And So it's their secret how they could choose some of them and say, look, those are the viral proteins using in the antibody tests. At this time, everybody was antibody testing. ELISA, you know, or Western blood. In principle, it's the same. So, well, of course, when I realized that there is a virus in the title, but no viral structure inside, I thought I have overseen something, or medical doctors are, you know, keeping their real isolation protocols secret, and I don't know. So I was not speaking with anybody on this because I was afraid losing my lab. I mean, in the fifth term as a young student, I had my own lab, access to every kind of electron microscopic and microscopic techniques, you know. So, but then I was sure. I was looking right and left. I saw, oh, measles virus the same. Hepatitis A and B, the same. A virus claim, but no virus. So, and this is how I went in. And then, of course, I blamed the other one, establishing the infectious theory, Robert Koch. I blamed him as, and Louis Pasteur, I blamed him as guilty of this betrayal, what's going on, you know. And in fact, Pasteur wrote down in his diary, which became public at the Princeton University in 93, you know, that he was cheating, that he was really intentionally killing sheep and saying, look, in public events, look, they died because they were infected and not vaccinated. And he was using sheep not infected, not treated with nothing, and said, look, they are vaccinated, they are infected, and nothing happens. And all sort of these things I found in his diary. And but to my great, I was really shocked when I was reading Max Perutz in my favorite newspaper. My favorite newspaper till this moment was the New York Review of Books. I mean, this is the intellectual flagship. I found such a lot of important articles in this paper. And all of a sudden, Perutz was writing. And, thanks God that Montané was cheating a little bit. Otherwise, the infectious theories would have no possibility to become a global act of knowledge. At this time, there were no proofs. And thanks God, Montané was exaggerating. So anyway, then I was going more back in history, where does the concept comes from? Because virus means a toxic protein, a toxic substance, a toxin of disease. That means virus in Latin. And so before 52, a virus was really thought to be a protein which is toxic. And only after 1922, a virus was thought to be a nucleic acid, a dangerous one. The poor one naked like Ebola and the rich one with an envelope. Anyway, so we have a paradigm shift in 52. And so I went back in history, where does this concept arose from? And I eventually landed at Rudolf Virchow in 1858. And then I understood very quick where this concept arose, because before there was the notion which originated in ancient Greek that the diseases are caused when a liquid inside your body, we had the four liquids, it's going to be stuck, and then this liquid turns out into a toxin, a toxic substance, which is causing disease. And this was the ancient theory of disease, the liquid, the humoral theory of disease. And this was abandoned already, because when there was light microscopes, even lens in 1650, my peaky, they saw, well, organs are built out of different layers of tissue. But when we have a change in an organ and a disease, the disease is not spreading left or to the right, never. So all observations are disproving, or were disproving, the theory that the toxin, it's built up somewhere in the body and it's spread by diffusion, right? So this was already abandoned. And Virchow also took a great deal to disprove this theory in 1884. But all of a sudden, 10 years older, for given reasons I won't outline here at the moment, he came up with a completely different theory, and he reactivated this old idea of a toxin, of disease, of a virus inside his new theory. And of course, he had to become famous, he was full of debts. His father put on him. He wanted to become a priest. His father forced him to study medicine. In 1848, he really claimed very important thing that all infectious diseases disappear immediately if the people became food, if they become water to wash, to clean, if they had no insects in their beds rotting around, if they can heat in winter. I mean, these were his claims in 1848. And for this, he's praised till today. But 10 years later, when the revolution and the time, the political situation in Germany becomes really stiff, much more harder than in 48, then he came up with a new theory. And he said, the cell, we are not originating out of tissues, which was already at this time was established fact. He said, we are coming out of single cells, and the cell is the smallest indivisible unit of life. And that all diseases are coming out of a single cell when the cell is producing the toxin of disease, so the virus. So this is the same idea of disease, the liquid theory, now produced or seen inside the cell. Why Virchow came up with this theory of a cell? Because, and this was the next great finding, that all our theory of life, that we are originating out of atoms, that atoms touching themselves, building molecules, and then life, it's coming out of this. This is not invented by the atom theory by Einstein, or even not by Virchow. This was invented in Greece by Democrit. And Epicure was transporting this, making it very public later on. This comes from old Greece, this theory, and Virchow just came across this theory and was using it. And because it was already fashionable in the Enlightenment, but also before, that all explanations of life should be without God, without ghost, without a field, without consciousness. This was one prerequisite in order to be a scientist, because this was the baseline of the Enlightenment as a counter action or counter reaction on more than 1,000 years of church misbehavior in Europe. And so all explanation on life could only be materialistic. And in fact, even those in the Enlightenment have not invented this theory. As I found when going back even more and more back in history, I landed at Democrit. And he said, we are producing a new theory of life because we want no God anymore inside the explanation for given reason, for good reason. He said that a lot of religions are causing fear in the people in front of God. They are afraid of God, that God is punishing, and God is punishing with disease. That was the Catholic Church telling for more than 1,000 years. You know, so they said, we want to have a theory of life without any of this sort. And they could not imagine that this became a religion on its own, you know, with the ancient theory that, yeah, when the liquids stock inside the body, then they turn into a toxic matter. And amen, this is it, what we have now. And not only in virology. Virology at the moment is the tip of the iceberg, the visible, very visible tip of the iceberg. But it's also the very sharp needle to implode the balloon, which we have and gets every day bigger, you know. But the challenge what we have, it's not only virologists, it's cancer, for example. It's all chronic disease. I mean, when somebody's believing that in his body, his own matter, its own substances turn into the bad, into a vicious thing, nobody is able to get it under control and it's going to eat you up. And even if that it's going to march, you know, inside your body, then we are in the theory of metastasis. So, and this is the majority of people believing it. And if, of course, if you are believing cancer, if you believe in metastasis, you are believing in flying metastasis, which you can spill out. And therefore we have to wear masks. And that's why the majority is believing into this concept. It's our history, and we have to face our history. And it's so deeply inside our thing that all our thinking, it's so deep in. And as a student, as a pupil, I had to learn all of this. And so if we castrate our imagination, right, we have no other means to imagine what is disease, or even what is health, you know. And this is the challenge, what we have to see, that we have to work to come back to the roots. And the roots have been in Ayurvedic medicine. I mean, there was the soul is dominating the whole thing. And then depending the liquid states inside your body, you know, which the Greek culture didn't understand. Of course, there are a huge body of proofs that the Greek culture was importing its medical knowledge from Ayurvedic philosophy, right? Which in India itself was destroyed by the British when they have been there and still are there. So the only original philosophy and schools of Ayurvedic medicine you will find in Sri Lanka, by the way. So anyway, this is the history not only of virology, this is the history of disease. And it becomes clear when we have a mind setting that inside our bodies, there is no field acting, no God, no spirit, no consciousness whatsoever. We are forced to think in materialistic interactions only. And even with Virchow, we are forced to think that when we are a bulk of minerals and whatsoever fatty acid proteins, that to direct all of this, that every organism comes out of one single cell, which is not true, by the way. And the whole cellular concept, it's not true. Please read your Harold Hillman. It's all there in English. So, but then you are forced to imagine a building plan and a functional plan for our cells to produce a human being. This is what we are forced to. And then we are already in the dead end and we go into details and blah and da. And yeah. And of course, we had then the shift in the paradigm shift, the paradigm shift in 52, that when they did the control experiments, they realized, oh, our proteins we consider to be a virus, they also came into existence when we let healthy organs, healthy tissue into decay. Then we have exactly the same. And in electron microscopy, we cannot see something specific. So, and then the new virology was orientating itself on those structures. I had the luck to isolate some of the out of the ocean. Nowadays, they call themselves, the virologists call themselves giant viruses because they have such a huge genetic material, you know, always the same length, always the same structure, always the same sequence. So, and what I found, it's not a harmless virus out of this thing. It's a kind of mini spore. It's not a spore itself. When the algae realized that there is no condition to build normal spores, which can swim, look to find a good place for itself and grow out again. So they built much smaller particles. And those particles were first detected, isolated, and characterized in bacteria. And in bacteria, they are called bacteriophages. Phage from phagocytosis, to eat, to swallow. But those structures are not eating the bacteria. This is a misconception. This is already, you know, a very narrowed view to the things. When bacteria are dying, it must be a virus, right? So, but in the end, these are mini spores which can themselves develop again into larger units. This was Enderlein already claiming that the cellular theory of life must be wrong, because he observed that a cellular structure disintegrate into smaller structures. He just could observe in a light microscope, and even smaller one, he could not observe anymore. And but also smaller structures do materialize out of invisible structures and forming cells. So this what he was seeing, and but this was the minority, because with Virchow's attempt was to unite medicine and state. 1848, for good reason, to help people, to avoid plagues and everything. And in 58, it was, he adapted to the new political situation. And he said, well, in medicine, it's like in state, the single cells could easily, you know, get parasitic, get egoistic, and then kill the head. And so it's in the state as well. One does not see it directly, but he gave some really good indications that he meant the Jewish people, that they easily can get out of control, get parasitic, you know, endangering the head, the king. And he was friend. He became friend to the king, because his uncle from his mother's side, Mr. Hesse, he was the friend of the king. And so he became a boss of the Charité in 58. I mean, the leading clinic in Germany, where now all the corona crisis originated out from. Only with Professor Trostens, the virologist from the Charité, managed that a local panic in Wuhan spread into a global panic. It was the doing of Professor Trosten, which I outlined in my papers on what he was doing. So this is the story from the detail, from a mini spore to bacteriophages, which then from in 54 became the model of viruses. How should a virus look like? A stable nucleic acid of a given size, given structure, given sequence, enveloped inside a shell out of protein. This is what we'll find in bacteriophages and giant viruses, better named mini spores, right? Smaller than the usual spores. So, and they become the model of how viruses should look like. So when then in 54, John Franklin Enders came up with the idea, okay, we don't know what is a virus, because the experiments 52 with bacteriophages disproven the old idea of virus, because the old idea was a protein is a toxic, a virus is a toxic protein, which the capability of self-replication, because it was thought the protein itself is the genetic material. So all proteins are able to self-replicate. But in doing research with bacteriophages in 52, it was become known that a protein always needs a nucleic acid to be replicated, right? For this, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was given in 69, and it's really interesting and important to check the justification of the Nobel Prize in 69 for the phage group, because the last sentence says, these phages became the model for the whole virology model. And here we are. What they are believing that when cells in the laboratory are dying, and this is what John Franklin was doing in 54. He was a bacteriologist. He knew, when we starve bacteria to death, and if we maltreat them, they all of a sudden transfer themselves into phages, which are there, of course. And he said, look, now we are without model of virology, but probably when cells are dying equally like bacteria in the test tube, probably it's the same that they transfer themselves into viral matter. This was in June 54, where nobody had an idea how a virus is going to look like, right? The old virus actually abandoned themselves. So, but because Enders got in December 54 the Nobel Prize for an old idea of him on poliovirus, the old virology from 48, this paper from June 54 became a scientific fact, which was never ever questioned. Even Enders was saying in his paper on the 1st of June 54 that this is speculation, that it's, we see a lot of contradictions, probably the cells dying because of unknown factors or another virus inside there. So here we go. They never took out control experiments, which we are now carrying out at the moment. Again, I carried them out in a measles virus process, which I won at the end. And we are carrying them out now, especially for Ebola. And they were not realizing, and not realizing till today, that they are killing those cells, intoxifying them with cytotoxic antibiotics, starving them to death, reducing the nutritions, and of course, adding material proteins which are in decay, and everything which is in decay, it's toxic and disturbing those cell cultures in the test tube. But when those cells are dying in the test tube, they equal it with the presence of the virus, with the isolation that they isolated from something outside the laboratory, inside the laboratory, and call it the isolate. And the material not being filtered, it's called the living virus, and it's used as a vaccine, you know, because they believe till today it's turning everything into viral matter, which is in the case in bacteria, but never proven in cells and disproven. And then they begin to take small pieces out of proteins and adding them up mentally to a model of a virus. They add up very small pieces of nucleic acid and add them up to a long nucleic acid, which is a pure mental product and never isolated, never seen anywhere. So this is the history of virology, how it evolved and how it became a self-fooling mechanism, of course, with fooling the whole society, but where there was a predisposition for, you know, disbelief, because there were no other thinking since 2,500 years. So this is it, what's going on. And I mean, in order to get clear, I recommend everybody go into the history. It helps to understand where this is coming from, why so much people are believing in this concept, why I myself was believing in this concept, everybody, you know. And then if you know the history, you know the way out. If you know the way in, you know the way out. So if you know the way the no in, then you are without orientation. Easy. So the next thing is, the virologists are doing 7 steps to fool themselves that, when they photograph something, it's a virus, or when they add up the small molecules to a big one, we have the viral genome. There are 7 points. And if you just read them in the papers, Material and Methods, of any virus, which is said to cause disease, you will find two sensational things. And I mean, it's easy like this. And it poor me that I only in this year I came across how easy it is and to, you know, but okay, that's it. So in every of those seven steps, you'll find that they are disproving themselves. They are really deemed virologists themselves are disproving themselves. And in every step, every technique they are using in these seven steps, those are seven techniques, right? They never took out control experiments to show if not the experiments themselves are producing the results. And a scientific paper without a control experiment, without the control that the technique I used is falsificate, it's varying the result or it's producing the result, it's not scientific. And therefore, the law, which regulates all means of pandemic measures, the law of infectious diseases, it disclaims and this asks everybody to act in a scientific manner, and science and the rules of science are defined. And therefore, just naming those seven facts and the anti-scientific behavior of the manifest anti-scientific proof of their own doing. This is what I ask in Germany now to do the people. I call this action the red card for Corona. And people are writing letters already to the health authorities and saying, look, those are the facts. You are academic. You can check it in 30 minutes. And therefore, no means could be supposed or posed upon me. I'm free. I must not take a mask. I must not take a test and so on. And this activity starts. And this, in the end, I'm absolutely sure, is going to let the balloon explode or implode, how you like it, right?
Stefan, could you walk us through those seven steps?
Oh, please, yeah. The first step I mentioned already. Since Enders, every virologist believes when his cell cultures are dying in the test tube, right, that there must have been a virus, but they never controlled it. So we controlled it twice already, and we get the cells dying without infectious material.
So in other words, whether you put an initial virus or not, you get the same result.
Exactly. And this is called the cytopathic effect, when some cells are causing to melt together or, you know, to just disappear. And when the button of the test tube becomes visible, this they call the cytopathic effect. And they equal it with the presence and the isolation of the virus. And then they believe the material which they'll find afterwards, this is of viral nature. This is in case of bacteria when they are producing phages, right? This is the case when I am producing giant viruses, mini spores, right? But this is not the case in the test tube with eukaryotic cells. So,
interestingly, Enders actually said that in his original paper, that we know that we get the same result even if we don't start with anything from a child with measles.
That's it. And he also said in this paper that probably this, what they are doing in the test tube, most likely has nothing in common with real measles. We have just to read it, you know. And of course, a little bit history helps here again. Enders never studied medicine or biology. He served in World War One as a pilot, as a young pilot already. He was 18, I think, there. And then he studied sociology. He was dandy. Of course, he was ambassador in all these elite universities and things. And then he studied after World War II. He studied again sociology and German language and Celtic, you know. So he ran into biologists working on phages. And as a soldier, viruses in bacteria. He just went in and he had not to study biology to just run into the lab and do his work and do his PhD on this. So he lacked every scientific thinking, right? And of course, some other details, because his idea for which he became the Nobel Prize in 48, it was stolen by Salk, and Salk made the vaccine and didn't give credit or any outcome of his gains to Enders. He had the idea that the polio virus, it's not tissue specific. So Jonas Salk was buying all human embryos all over the world, taking the skin up and the muscles down, and fermented it with a piece of brain of a polio diseased human being. And then this was the polio vaccine, right? So, yeah. And this was the reason why Enders was completely fed up, and all the scientific community. You can read this really very happily on on Wikipedia, even.
Yeah.
You find on the English Wikipedia page, you'll find this story on Enders.
Okay, so let's go to the next arts of the seven.
They never take carried out control experiments, but they considered their molecules of the dying cells as viral. Okay.
Yeah.
The next step, what they are doing, they use particles inside the tissue. They fix the tissue and cut it in thin slices, and look through the electron microscope. And they find some typical structures of dying cells, villi, some tissue dots. They walk like amoebs. And when they cut through with the electron microscope, they show only the circles and claim, oh, those are viruses. But they never ever were isolating those structures, showing, look, this is the viral nucleic acid inside, the viral proteins. And no control experiments. They never did the same with tissue cultures, exactly treated in the same manner. You must imagine, they never ever did it. So this is point two. Then point three is they come up with another sort of particles, claiming where they said, oh, those are viral particles. And if you go into the technical details, you easily see that they centrifuge all the proteins in a test tube down to the button. And then they take it up with a syringe and mix it. And so they vortex this mixture out of proteins, fatty acid, and detergents. And what we have soap bubbles. The German expression is micelle. I think in English it's micelle, right?
Yeah,
so the soap bubbles. And they add color, stain, let it dry, and use another technique of electron microscopy to look from above on these particles. So the same, they never isolated those particles and say, look, here we have the biochemistry, we have the viral proteins, we have the viral nucleic acid. They don't have it, okay? So, and they did not a control experiment. They never tried it with uninfected, but same treated cell cultures in the same way, never. So it's completely, this behavior, it's anti-scientific in point one, point two, point three, and all other points to come. The fourth point, the fourth step, what they are doing, from billions of small genetic debris, they are sequencing, they read the sequence of very small pieces, and then they add them up to a large piece. They add them up, and this process is called alignment. And it's incredible that they never ever carried out a control experiment with equally treated cell cultures, equally treated cell culture, and just doing the same. No control experiments. And the fact which itself they are disproving themselves, they add something to a big piece, and the big piece never ever showed up in reality. And since 50 years, it's easy to show up that there is a big genetic material of this given size is there. This is called gel electrophoresis. This is a standard technique to show, yeah, I have a piece of genetic material this given size. With this technique, all bacteriophages are genetically, from their nucleus acids, they were characterized, right? And So this is point four. Point five, in order to build a genome of the virus, when they came up, oh, I find a new virus in Wuhan, or I repeat the experiment, they always need a given genome as a point of orientation where they add the smaller pieces, where they do fit to a given genome. So this would be like a sentence out of the Bible from with 30,000 letters, right? And we use a small letters combination of 1, 2, 3, 5 letters and try to fix them to the place where they fit, right? And no control experiments again. And the control experiments would be to try to get the alignment of another RNA virus, which would be a measles virus, which would be Ebola virus, HIV, right? This would be the control experiment with the same data set. Let's try if we can fabricate another virus. And I can tell you, yes, it's like this. I showed it already in the measles virus process. And here in Corona, it's going to shown hopefully soon, right?
So, in other words, you can take the same raw data set, the same pieces of short pieces of RNA in the mixture, and then you can create you can find the template for the coronavirus, or yes, the template for the HIV virus, or yes, the template for the measles That's virus, it. And then yes, you tell the computer to orient it or align it to that yes, template, and in each case it will, which will make That's you it. Say, yes, I found this person has measles, they have HIV, they yeah, have Ebola, they have yeah, Zika, and by the way, they have coronavirus.
That's it. Yes. That's it. So, and this is then the definite experimental disproof, you know. And can you imagine? The coronavirus is said that it mutated 2 years ago. It becomes into existence, right? So I'm now on my way to find an old data set 10 years ago on measles virus, right? Or on HIV, right? And as soon as I get hold of original sequence data, which was produced for HIV, I'm going to produce you coronavirus.
SARS-CoV-2,
definitely. And this is going to be the definitely experimental disproval of virology. But yeah, till we have this, the arguments on its own, it's enough, because we are inside point five, yes? Yeah. And inside point five, where they use a given sequence to add the smaller sequences accordingly, right? This sequence, this given sequence, never ever came out of a virus. It's a biological unit. Itself, always, it's a fabricated thing, right?
Right.
So virology has no viral genome. And everything what they use in order to do an alignment, it's a fabrication on its own already.
Yeah, that's why they call it an in silico genome of an in silico virus.
That's it. That's yeah, it. Yeah. But in silico, I mean, even this is a little bit, this, you know, because in silico there is some matter, but of course in silico, yes. In English, it sounds better than in German. Okay. No, it's a good
experience. It means it's okay, inside the computer only.
Yeah,
not,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not okay, in reality.
So let's come to point six, you know. Everybody thinks, and it was your question at yeah, the beginning, if that virology never ever saw a virus inside a living being or inside its liquids. And it's easy. Everybody can check it easily on every single photograph of a virus, which should show a virus. You'll find the notion that it's from a cell culture, but never from the blood, never from the salvia, never from the semen, never from another liquid of the body, never from a lymph node, never from inside, not from a human, not from an animal, not from a plant. And this is astonishing. I mean, they they go to the moon, they go to the Mars, whatsoever, but they never managed to get a virus photographed inside a human being, nor that they can show its nucleic acid inside a liquid, body liquid, salvia or blood. We have all to wear masks in order not to spread the virus with every breath take, you know, thousands of them, but they never ever. And this is completely unscientific not to tell the public that they never ever were able first not to show a virus in salvia blood inside a human being, and second, never ever were able to see the gene, the complete genome of a virus inside blood, inside salvia. You know, never ever. And this is point six.
You know, Stefan, let me just comment on that. I spent some part of this morning looking in PubMed for any paper that described the morphology of a virus from a living human being or living tissue, living diseased person.
Yeah.
And there are a few papers that claim that, but when you actually read the details, they say, well, they have very different morphologies. In other words, some of these particles look like bullets and some of them look round and some of them look like rods, and somehow they're all the same virus. Yeah. And it's bizarre. It's like,
What they are doing, they say, look, we stain some of the proteins. Yeah. We have some specific antibodies. They are connected with a staining. And then we'll see something inside the body. This is what they are doing, of course. But it's not showing that there is a particle somewhere. And the definition of a virus, it's always its core. And that's the genetic material. And here we go. This has a given size, a given structure, and a given sequence. And this never, ever shows up somewhere. And you must imagine all these masks, you know, and Biden are calling for two masks, you know. I mean, how crazy. And so, but on the other hand, thanks God, how could you think of a change, of a paradigm shift in society without such a crisis? Impossible. Right. When I think a year back, I could not imagine that we had a success going to the streets. Now the people are listening on the streets. And now in Germany, the politicians are saying, look, 30% of the German population, it's not believing in virus anymore. And so we need another 20%. And then the next election, then it's done, you know. And this is our work, what we have to do, to convince the facts, naming the facts where everybody can, on its own, can check it and can check the logic. And the seventh point, it's very interesting, because in a review work of the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science, they published a review of 89 pages to the earlier history of virology. Tom, can I have a short break? There is the bell down running.
Yeah, well, I was going to try to finish, but yes, if you need to
okay,
go.
I come back soon, so you take over, okay?
Okay. Not sure how. So I think what we'll do here is we'll hear the seventh, and then I'm going to ask Stefan how people can learn more about what he's doing and how to even participate and maybe help his studies. I think then what I'll do is when we have the Friday session, there may be some things that Stefan said that I can try to further explain. So I will try to do that on Friday during the usual, I think it's 2:00 Eastern time session. This, you know, it's interesting, this last point, point six, is something that's just so key to this whole thing. Because if you ask well, if you tell anybody out there, have they ever actually seen, isolated, characterized, and found the entire genome of a single so-called pathogenic virus from a person who's sick with that disease? I have spent hours and hours looking through PubMed, searching, all the sites that any doctor or anybody can get access to. And there's literally no article that demonstrates that. As hard as that is for all of us to believe, as hard as that is to wrap your brain around, that's just the fact. Some of the ones I found today, because I was determined to see if there was even one article. They make references to something, but it's not anything like Stefan is describing. All right, Stefan, we'll do seventh, and then I want you to tell people how they can help you do with this, where they can go to get more information, maybe contribute, donate, or just find out more about what they can do to help.
Well, there are some important English text on my webpage, freely available. For further information, I think the most important thing is to study the deeper biology. There are already three translation of three texts on mine. And the basis is the findings of Dr. Hammer, which he once called the new medicine, right? This is the actual and really scientific form of psychosomatic, but psychosomatic would be too short as explanation. He came for his own experience with, after his son died, he developed the cancer of testicle, and then he thought, well, does it happen to others? He asked other patients, and he said, yeah, how do you know that my child died? And he said, it happened to me. So he went into brain scans himself and others with the same diagnosis. And he found that always in the same part of the brain, the same disease gives a signal, right? And so he could, he thought that he solved all the open questions on cancer. But later he found it that it's with skin, with hair, with teeth, with everything, and this findings are of greatest importance to study, because you learn two things. Second, that the old model that something from outside comes inside and destroying you can't possibly be true. And the most important is you learn how spirit works, how spirituality works on you, how we are functioning. You see that every part of your body has its own consciousness of his function at this side, being the skin on the outside or a part of the organ inside, and does it it can change when it becomes under pressure. This could be a really accident, but also a situation where you are believe that you are live under a constant alarm, that it becomes exceptional, that the thing what happened, it's too much for you. You are isolated from everybody. And then your flesh, it's changing. And, everybody knows a word can kill and a word can heal. And this you are going to learn when you are checking this information on the new medicine. I think, Tom, you had an interview already with a lady in the States working on this. At least Andy had them.
We haven't done it yet, but we're going to get to that. But let's just, I just want to wrap this up just so we're careful of your time here, Stefan. So maybe just go through the seventh point just quickly.
Okay. The seventh point, it's easy. In this review where I spoke about of the Max Planck Institute on history of science, there you can read that when the old virology was disproving itself themselves, they find out when they took out animal experiments they never ever were able to transmit a disease, an infectious disease. But this is said nowadays, you know, that we have a model for COVID-19, we have a model for measles, we have this and that. So, and if you check these publications, you'll see that they are A, completely anti-scientific because no controls, and B, that the treatment of the animals injecting large amounts of liquid into the brain, inside the ear, inside the eye, with a tube inside your lungs, that the conditions of the experiments themselves are causing the disease.
Yeah, right.
It's easy like this.
Okay.
So that was the 7 points.
Okay. Stefan, tell us your website so that people can find out more.
So the website is Wissenschaft Plus with double F. Probably you spell it.
Yeah, we'll put it on the show notes, okay, or something like that.
And probably I think soon there is going to a translation of the red card for Corona, okay, right? This is a web page where I have the 7 points inside. I hope soon there is going to be a book published, or our book in German, Corona, Further into Chaos, or A Chance for Everybody, that yeah, this is going to be in English as well. And anyway, I mean, you have such a lot of information attracted in your work. I mean, the importance of nutrition and all those things. There's such a lot of information out there, and you contributed a lot.
I think the bottom line here, Stefan, if you agree, is that it's the chemistry and the structure follows consciousness, not the other way around.
That's it, and that's the most important thing. When you see the work of Hammer, he had printed out a big tabella where you'll find, according to all kind of tissues, to the four tissues we have,
yeah,
and you'll find every piece of organ or skin, you know, what may happen here or there. And if you see it and you turn it into the positive, that not the trauma is acting, which he terms a biological conflict, but you turn it into its function, then you see the building map of God, of your body. I mean, how it's meant. And it's immediately a proof that when everything has its consciousness at its place and inside your, then of course it had its consciousness inside the whole context.
Yeah.
Because we don't start and end where we are visibly be seen, because we have to breathe, and this is the energy which comes into us, you know, and it's not only coming from the sun. We are connected with everything. And I mean, this is probably the most important information. For me, it was the most important thing, that I could get rid of this atom theory living in the nowhere, in the vacuum, you know. And so this is just not true. We are living in the ether, and the substance water is building when building a surface, this thin lining. This is the own substance on its own, and that's the substance our tissue are out of. This substance creates everything, and even all the molecules and elements, and they go back into this substance. And this is the reason that the stronger we are in the mind, the stronger we can deal with toxins and with everything. I mean, look into the prisons where people are not well nourished, and the ones who have a clear mind, a clear belief, and they go out strong, upright, and healthy, no thieves, loves, you know. So those are the proofs that the consciousness, you know, goes before. And of course, when the matter is there, our body, we have to fulfill its own rules, you know, the blood streaming, the oxygen, the flow of energy and information, and being connected with it. And the one who is happy, who has his belief, that he is wanted and that he's part of a thing, you know, because I think the most cruel thing in life is that you really believe, or you are afraid that you are a product of by accident. And then if you disintegrate, nothing will rest. And this thing which Friedrich Nietzsche was writing down step by step what this makes out of a human being and out of him, driving him directly into madness. This is the main source, I think, the main reason why humankind is so mad, why they are so greedy, why they want to prove themselves, you know, in their short lifetime to become rich, to be powerful, to compensate this, you know, as this incredible notion. Yeah.
It's a misconception. It's a huge misconception.
It's a huge misconception, and in our culture, it's originated some 2,500 years ago, and we have a chance now to reverse it.
Change the whole thing.
Yeah.
Stefan, okay, we're going to do this again someday, and we're going
As often as needed, as often as wanted. I thank you very much for your dedication, for your students, for your friends, for your Great. Colleagues.
Stefan, thank you. Everybody go to Stefan's website, read the papers. They're amazing. And Stefan, thank you very much. And yeah, we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.